You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
For the more hardcore fans of The Dan Nichols Show, most of you I know listening while serving 8 to 10 for a series of offences, you'll know that the host has a multitude of claims to fame. One that doesn't often get out about me, though, is that for one glorious year, I captained the Watershed College tennis team. Now, this was not necessarily down to extraordinary ability, but rather because everybody else was a bit younger and I was given the role through seniority. But it did speak to a sport I loved playing, a sport I love watching, a sport I've been lucky enough to see in different parts of the world and to meet some great names from, be they Djokovic, Federer, Nadal, Alcaraz, Williams, or, of course, the biggest of the lot, Diaga, who just happens to be with me today. John Luffney, Diaga, welcome.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
I don't know if you knew I was my school tennis captain.
I heard that one before.
It does not speak terribly highly of tennis at Watershed College at that time. In fact, I remember, if I go back even further, playing the Springvale House Junior School tennis team, where myself and Mark Van Munigen were humbled very publicly and to our enormous embarrassment, because this was not a time when there was a great deal of belief in gender parity. We lost to the grade sixers from Chisapeake Girls' School, who were led by a then little-known Cara Black, who destroyed us. So there's plenty of tennis going back. It's a sport I love, and it's why I'm really excited to have you in for a multitude of reasons. You're doing some really, really exciting stuff in the tennis world. But you've also, as that faint whisper of an Australian accent suggests, just got back to South Africa, having had a huge amount of fun at what is almost the South African Open rather than the Australian, because it's one of your great friends who runs what has to be the greatest tennis show on earth.
Yes, Dan, it's amazing what Craig Tiley has done with the Australian Open. He's been there for more than 20 years, and it was the small Grand Slam. It was the smallest one of them all. And, you know, when he started taking over, Craig is somebody that he loves innovation, and it's not just about tennis. So it's become a festival. It's become a festival where there's over 100 music acts that, perform over three weeks. The Grand Slam has become 3 weeks. That qualifying week, you know, he's packing Rod Laver three nights with exhibitions. He had Roger Federer there this year. So it's incredible what he's done. And, I've got a great history with and fond memories of the Australian Open. I made my first Grand Slam semifinals there at the age of 19. And because of Craig as well, you know, go there every year. And it's just amazing what they've done. And what the tennis that we saw this year was incredible.
I don't think any sport at the moment is now relying just on the sport itself. It's all become spectacle. It's all become festival where, yes, even if you're not a diehard fan of that sport, you're still going along to have an incredible time. But there does seem to be a magic to the Australian Open that Craig Tiley and his team, and he'll be the first to say, it's a very big team, have managed to create. What is it about what they've done that has made this quite so successful?
He does things that you think that it shouldn't be at a tennis tournament. But interesting thing about it, you know, 85% of people that go to Australian Open is Australians. 70% of them live in Melbourne. So he's constantly has to change that people don't show up and say, oh, it looks exactly like last year. Compared to the other slams, I mean, the base of people that they can tap into to come to a Wimbledon is a lot more. So he's very, very innovation. What he does is he gives every single person that works at Tennis Australia, he's like, you're the CEO. Come up with an idea how we're going to make the Australian Open better. So everybody feels part of the success of the Australian Open. So there's ideas come from everybody. He's not a guy that takes, it was me. He relies on his team and he gives them, you know, credit. And, you know, they feel like he empowers them to come up with stuff. And that's why, you know, for me, the Australian Open, every year you come, you go like, what's the next thing he's going to do? What's the next thing he's going to do? I remember the first time the players wanted to boycott the Australian Open. Well, the Grand Slams, because they wanted to get more money. And he was the first Grand Slam. So everybody was looking at what he was going to do. And I remember what he did was suddenly he gave everybody $2,000. Welcome to Australia. So you get your food, you get your per diem. On top of that, you get $2,000. People were talking about that, not about the increase of prize money. They were so happy. You get into a car, there's a, you know, when you arrive in Australia, there's a gift. There's a gift in a hotel. He was the first one that said that the day that you play, you can get up to 7 rackets strung for free. So all these little freebies. I mean, it's funny sportsmen. They make millions, but when they get a freebie, man, they're the first one that's there. So he's been incredible with that.
And you've watched it grow, both from the perspective of a great friend and champion. Craig did so much for your career, but also somebody who knows tennis as intimately as anybody in South Africa because of a career that I don't know we celebrate quite as much as perhaps we should. And we see you coaching all over the world with great success, and we will talk about it in a moment. But let's go back to this tennis career, making Grand Slam semifinals when you're 19, getting into tennis. How did John Lufney Diago first of all discover that, you know, I'm actually rather good at this sport, and then start to realize, well, you know what, I'm actually very good, and maybe there's something I can do with this?
Dan, when I was born, my mother's heart stopped, and my heart stopped, and they did give me an injection to get my heart going, and they injected me in my butt instead of my thigh, and they hit the nerve going down my right leg. So I literally only have 10% use of my nerve in my right leg. They told my parents I'll never be able to do any sport, 12% chance of walking properly, and at the age of 18, I'll probably need to get an operation. I'm not allowed to walk barefoot, and yeah, so no sport. So my dad was sport crazy. We lived on a farm. He threw my shoes away. He said, you'll walk barefoot. And thanks to my dad and my mom, their attitude towards a disability was the reason that I was brought up normal. In 2000, when I went to the Sydney Olympic Games, they did a test, and I qualified to go to the Paralympics. So I have a serious disability, but the mindset of my parents was the reason why I never saw myself as somebody that had a disability. And, you know, tennis, cricket, rugby, everything. I mean, my dad always joked. He said, if he left my bed at school, I'll sleep there. Because I was in the choir. I was in the band. I just loved hanging out with my friends and doing all the sport. Then at the age of 12, we were selected by South African Tennis Federation to go in a big squad. But now Amanda Kutzer, Wayne Ferreira, Marcus Grant, they're all in that squad. And we played in I came third at the Orange Bowl. That was one of the biggest junior.
That's massive, because that's all over the world, best young tennis talent.
I came third. And then in Port Washington, I became the first South African ever to win the Port Washington tennis tournament. And there was, I'll never forget, it was a wooden stand with a crystal ball on, with all the names of all the players that has won it as juniors. McEnroe, Connors, Edberg. I was seeing all these big names that won this event when they were young. And I thought to myself, wow, maybe I must take tennis up a little bit more seriously, because tennis was like my third sport. I mean, rugby and cricket is my sports that I love. And I'll play tennis like 2 weeks before the holidays. And then the holidays, I'll play tennis, pack my bags away, and I'll do all the other stuff. So that is where it changed for me when I won that international event, where I'm like, okay, maybe I'm not too bad at this. I mean, I must maybe just focus on it a little bit more. And then really, you know, probably from the age of 16, that's where I really started focusing. You know, I missed 21 weeks of school in grade 8, 24 weeks in grade 9. And then everybody, Wayne, Amanda, they were all doing homeschooling. And I came with this great idea to my parents one night at dinner. I said, you know, I want to do homeschooling. My mom obviously was like, no, you'll not. You'll finish your school. And my dad was very open-minded, and he looked at me. He says, okay, sounds like a plan. He says, but you will get your matric. I don't care how you do it. That's one. You get matric. So we started figuring out what I needed to do. So you were not allowed to write a national exam and a TOD exam in a public school. So we had to go to the inspector of education to get special permission for me to leave school, because the year that you turn 16, you've got to finish that year before you can leave. And I turned 16 on the 17th of March. So I was going to waste how many months sitting at school. So we had to go for permission. And my dad had a way of doing things. And the plan was I was going to do two subjects in grade 10, two in 11, and two in 12. So it's over 3 years, I'm going to do my six subjects. We get in the car and we go and we drive. And as we stop in the parking lot, my dad goes, why don't you do all six subjects? And I'm like, no, Dad, please don't change the game plan now. I mean, we have a plan here. And he's like, imagine you pass three subjects, then you have one bonus. She says, maybe you pass four subjects, then you have 2 year bonus. Maybe you pass everything, then you score 2 years. And I'm like, okay, we'll do it. There's a reason why my dad did it, because my foot is the reason that, you know, if somebody tells me I can't do it, I'm going to show you that I can do it.
Yeah, you're a stubborn soul.
I'm like, and you know, I'm not going to quit. I'll probably hurt myself. I'm not going to quit. And my dad knew that's my how my head worked. And then, especially when people tell me I can't do it. So we go in, and my dad had a thing. He said, you wanted to leave school, you run this meeting. I'm going to say hello. I'm going to sit back and watch you. So I got in there and, you know, said hello. And, you know, he said, what's the problem? I said, listen, I'm missing so much school and I want to leave school, but, you know, I need permission from you. And he's like, so what's the plan? I said, no, I'm flying over for 6 months, going to do this, this, and this. And he said, and you want to write matric, all six subjects in 1 year? He said, in Afrikaans, he said, my sien, das geen kans nie. You have no chance of doing it.
Which was exactly what you needed to hear.
I'm like, my dad, if there was a video there, my dad probably had a smile, because I literally got up and I said, I bet you I'm going to do it. And then we go out, Dan, and we get in the car and we're driving, and it felt like hours, but probably 2-3 minutes. I'm thinking, my dad's going to give me the biggest hiding, because that was arrogant. So I'm sitting, I'm waiting for him to say something, and he doesn't say anything. And I'm like, come on, speak to me, talk to me. And then eventually I go, I'm like, Dad, I'm very sorry, man. That was probably arrogant. He says, yeah. But now you go show him. And that was the way where I always say, you know, the biggest gift that God gave me was a disability. Because I, every single day, I struggle with this disability. So anything else is actually easy, because when people with disabilities, you know, if you think about the disability the whole time and you think about all your problems, then it becomes massive. And my parents were just unbelievable with it. So it was, for me, it was great. And then we started. I mean, I finished school. I went to the army when I was 16. It was still compulsory to go to the army. It was the best time of my life that I never want to do again. And just learned so much from it. And then, yeah, I started playing then. I started playing on the tour. I was very fortunate. I got an early break, you know, in Australia where it started. I played with Marcus Andruska. But it's interesting. First round, 4-4 in the third set. I went up for an overhead and I came down and I ripped the ligaments in my ankle. But in my bad foot.
So you can feel it.
I only have 10% feel. So, I mean, I was swelled up and I saw it was a little bit sore, but obviously not the same. It was in my left foot. So the trainer came on, taped my ankle. He told, you know, Bill Norris, he said, you know, you got to stop. I'm like, no, I'm not going to drop my partner. I'm going to play. So we end up winning. So now we're through in the first round. We have to play number two seeds. So I stayed with people. I packed my bags because I was, you know, I was going to play. And from there, I was going to go straight to the airport, go home, because, I mean, I was hopping. I couldn't really step on my foot. And I just, you know, I was on the court. We played against Leach and Jones. They were number two seeds. And Marcus knew. I said, listen, I'm going to swing from the hips. Got nothing to lose. We beat the number two seeds. Then I took my bags, went back home, knocked on the door like, what are you doing? Anyway, and as it happened, then in the third round, we beat Wayne Ferreira and Peter Norville. Ended up making the quarterfinals. We played Laurie Warder and Donnie Fisser. In the semis, but in the quarterfinals, we two sets to one up, 4-3. And I don't know what I did was I went up to hit an overhead again. And when I landed, it felt like I jumped into a knife. So now I'm lying there, and Bill Norris comes out the train, and he goes like, have you had enough now? And I'm like, no. I'm not. I'm going to go. And he literally made me sign a piece of paper, because he said he was going to write that he doesn't want to take any responsibility. So we end up winning that match. And then, you know, in the semifinals, we lost to Donnie and Laurie. And then I came back, and Dr. Fiferrer had always looked at my ankle from a young age. He said, listen, if you play singles and doubles, your back's not going to survive. He said, so you've got to choose. And obviously, after making the semifinals, you know, my ranking was in the top 70 in the world. I got into the big event. So it was an easy decision for me. But actually, 6 months prior to that, I qualified for singles and doubles at Wimbledon. So my first big thing that I did in tennis was qualifying for Wimbledon in singles. So people remember me as a doubles player, but for me, it's always that, you know, qualifying at singles. I dreamt my whole life of playing at Wimbledon. Remembering as a little boy, I would watch, you know, Jimmy Connors would play. And he had like a white brace around his arm. And, you know, when the match was done, I went into my cupboard. I took my new cricket socks. I cut them, put them on, and I was hitting because my dad built a tennis court for us there. And that's how I remembered Wimbledon. So that first time when I qualified for Wimbledon was just spectacular. I mean, moments that you don't forget is the first time I walked onto the center court at Wimbledon. The moment when we walked into in 2000, when we walked into the arena at the Olympics. I mean, it's stuff that we are fortunate that nobody can take it away from you. And you can't explain to people really what it feels like.
It's just electric.
Yeah, and so yeah, and then my doubles career started, and I was fortunate. I made I served for the match of the Australian Open, and we lost 7-5 in the third. We lost 7-6, 7-6 in the finals of the French Open, and yeah, I made the five semifinals. We came fourth at the Olympics. I mean, what a bad place to finish. Rather come 150 than fourth. So I've been very fortunate, Dan. It's been a great career along the line. Met some incredible people. And yeah, my passion while I was playing, obviously my passion for coaching, you know, just more and more, you know, and Craig played a massive role in it. Christo van Rensburg, he helped me a lot. He gave me my break. You know, he was ranked 20 in the world and I got into events with him and we did well. And that's how my ranking got higher. So yeah, I've got special people in my life that helped me. And it's been an incredible journey tennis-wise. And then obviously from a coaching perspective, you know, I love it and been fortunate to, you know, to have all the big names, Roger, you know, Novak, you know, now just now Rybakina on my team that's won slam. So you learn from those people. My dad told me once, he said, you ask questions and you listen. And then you take that stuff that can help you and you fit it into your life. But if I don't have my pin location where I want to go, I don't know what's going to work for me. So the most important thing, I think, in life for us is not just in sport, in life, you need to know where you want to go.
You've also, in terms of where you want to go, which a big part is this coaching journey, you've got to have the ability to coach. And not every great player can. And often it's the players who've gone through a few more struggles who become the better coaches because they understand that that's what they need to help the next generation with. The fact that the names that you mention want you involved in their coaching spaces underscores that this is something you have got right. What is it about coaching, about being able to spend time with players, watch them grow under you, that you find so rewarding?
The biggest lesson that I've learned is that we think we have the knowledge and we want to tell them. We need to ask questions. Because if I don't know what you know, how can I coach you? So ask questions, figure out what players know. And then when they start talking to you, you realize, okay, I can't teach them that because they don't understand. I first have to understand it. But the willingness, what I've learned around the world is all these guys and ladies that are good, they're like sponges, man. They ask. I mean, I remember the first time I sat on the court with Roger. He's like, you know, we sat down and I'm like, Roger, I saw something. Can I tell you? He says, please tell me. You know, it's not that, you know, you don't have to tell me anything. Novak is the same thing. He's like, you know, share with me and I will take what I think can help me.
But that must be intimidating, though. I remember when Gary Kirsten got the job with India and he speaks about the first net session watching Sachin Tendulkar and thinking, what on earth do I tell Sachin Tendulkar about cricket? You've had a very impressive career, but you're now on court with one of the all-time greats. Are you second-guessing yourself? Are you asking yourself, what's John Lufney-Diaga telling Roger Federer about his tennis? Yeah. How intimidating was that in its early days?
It's very, man. You're nervous. It's like when you have match point to qualify for Wimbledon, that elbow becomes heavy, man. And like, yeah, and it's true. You see stuff and you say, I mean, it'll be easy if you say to a junior or player that's top 20, but now it's Roger Federer. The great thing about those guys are they make you feel comfortable. And nothing that you tell them, they'll think, oh, that's something dumb. They always take it as, okay, I must learn from this. There's one thing that he will say that I can take and it will make me better. And all those guys have made me feel so comfortable around them. So what I normally do when I coach a team, because I don't coach them full time, so you have maybe a week or maybe three nights with them, I sit with them and I say, listen, you know, when I sit with you on the changer, what do you want me to talk to you about? I talk tactics, do I talk, you know, tactical stuff? Do you want me to tell you a joke or whatever? And they will speak to you and tell you exactly, this is what I need. I want you to focus on this. I want you to focus on this. You know, Andrei Rublev is funny. Yeah, I love that guy, man. So we've now won three titles together. And, you know, the first time when I sat with him, I said, what do I talk to you about? He looked at me and says, JL, you know when to talk and when not to talk. So, and it's literally like you can see exactly, okay, when you have to speak to them. Dan, one of the other parts that we do now with my mental conditioning is that we do, it's called the mic code, we do laterality profiling. You know, just to watch your dominant hand, ear, foot, brain. And according to that, we all have a default setting. And that has really helped me so much with my players, because if I don't know what you see, what you hear, and how you process information, you're going to miss the 1 or 2 percenters. You hear coaches go, I just told them that not to do it. Yeah, but you spoke Greek to them and they speak Afrikaans. So you need to speak the language that your player or your team understands. There's some players in your team that want you to be firm. There's some players that doesn't want to be firm. Because if you're a left ear dominant, you don't hear what people say. You hear how they say it. So as soon as the coach starts raising his voice, they switch off. So you need to know that. And that's really helped me so much in coaching, because I pick up this stuff. I sit with them and I ask them, you know, let's see what's your eye dominance. I speak to them and I see how they turn their ears, what dominance their ears. And then you figure stuff out and it makes it easy for you. And I think it's very important for coaches, teachers, you know, people in corporates. Do you know the people that you work with? Do you know what language they speak? Because you can have your way, but your way, they maybe don't understand. So we have the knowledge, but we have to adapt so the people that have to execute understand what we're telling them.
Which leads into a space where I don't fully understand why things haven't gone as well as they perhaps could. And I know you're doing a lot to change that, and we'll look at that in a sec. But that is South Africa and tennis. We have amazing schools playing tennis. We have incredible weather. We have, and I'm a very good example, lots of very naturally athletic people who live in South Africa. And yet we don't see the world rankings peppered with South Africans. We haven't seen a major tennis event pretty much since your incredible match in Africa, which you put together brilliantly and gave us a wonderful show. But that was very much a one-off for that year. And I know there's more stuff on the horizon. But just this consistent feel that South Africa, both locally and on the world stage, is having a real impact on tennis. We'll see a college player come through now and again. And I know, you've got some more on the horizon. But I always feel that we're not delivering as perhaps we could as a tennis country. First of all, is that a fair assessment? And if it is fair, then why are we maybe not doing quite as well as perhaps we could?
It's definitely a fair assessment. We were definitely not where we were. So growing up in my time, when I was young, we had players that was playing at the biggest stage that inspired us to play. We had great venues. We had a lot of tournaments, local tournaments where people can play. Didn't have to go overseas to play. We were 32 South Africans playing at Wimbledon in 1999. We were 17 guys in the top 100 in doubles, 5 in the top 15, 5 guys in the top 100 in singles, and we had 4 ladies that was in the top 100 in the world in singles, all playing. And we were inspiring the next generation. And there was opportunities. Federation had squads growing up, squads that took us to all these international events, got exposure playing against the best players in the world. And that's not happening now. So now we don't have facilities. We don't have events. So the only path for us to make it is to go through college. And it's an expensive sport. People don't understand. But right now, if you have a top player, you know, Devin Barner is one of the kids that I coach. You know, he's probably going to be our next star. I believe he's very good. His budget is $2 million a year if we want to do it properly. Because you need to have a coach. You need to have a fitness trainer. You know, so it's 9 meals a day that you're paying for. It's 3 airline tickets. It's 3 hotel rooms. So now you're traveling around the world. So it's very expensive. And we don't have that. So what has happened in the last 2 years, there's a lot more junior ITF events that the federation and individuals are putting up. That's really helped us because the juniors can play and they can get international points. So when they travel, at least you get in. Slowly we're getting more, 15,000 futures and 30,000. But we were lacking the next level. It's the ATP challenges, because that runs from a 50,000 to a 175, and then the 250s is a tour events. So that in between, we don't have. So what we've secured now is this year, there's actually going to be a great schedule for them. In April, there's 4 futures that the players can play. Then we secured 4 challenges that for the next 3 years are going to be hosted in South Africa. That is great for us. So we have end of May, first week in June, there's 2 $50,000 challenges. And then the end of July, first week in August, we have another 2 challenges, a 50 and a 75. And that last 2 years, 2, 3, that this becomes bigger events, then hopefully where we can get to the South African Open again. But now we're giving our kids the opportunity to play, earn international points. So when they travel, at least they get into the tournaments. Now Tunisia and Egypt is the cheapest place actually for us to play. Tunisia have like 52 weeks of tournaments, just back to back. So when we go there and you don't have points, you don't even know if you can play. Now when we have local events, we can get our players can get points. And when they go there, at least they know that they're going to get into it. So, yeah, we're very excited about the four challenges that we're going to host at, you know, Irini Country Club. It's going to be festival. I'm lucky. I've been coach and I know a guy that runs a pretty big event in Australia. That's helping us as well.
And he will do so very happily because Craig is such a proud South African.
Yes.
And it's lovely that not just Craig, there's so many other people in the tennis community who, because of your years and years of playing and coaching and networking and with the reputation, the name you have, you can draw on all of that. And that will have helped us create these next tournaments, which I'm very excited about coming to watch and cheering on and seeing unfold. There are also the two other spaces, and I, you can shut me down if it's information that is not in the public realm, but I've heard whispers that there might be another match in Africa, and I'm hoping to play this time, and also hearing rumours that there might be something exciting in Stellenbosch. How much can be said? What do we know? What's in the open forum, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely, you know, we're working on, you know, doing the next match in Africa because it's, you know, Holger Losch, my partner, our company No Boundaries, that's what we want to bring. We want to bring international tennis to South Africa. And then we're very excited, Dan, you know, the University of Stellenbosch has donated some land to us to build a state-of-the-art racquetball facility for Africa. So we're planning on building 6 indoor courts, some paddle and pickle courts. There's going to be accommodation for 40 players where we're going to draw the best players in Africa to come and train. So we have a central base where they can train, a little stadium where we can host events, and then some 7 hard courts, 4 clay courts. It's going to be great because for the first time in 12 months of the year, the people in Stellenbosch can play, you know, racket sports, because if it rains, there's no facilities right now.
So this will have community access as well as...
100%. It's going to be for the community. Yep. That if you're 5-year-old and you want to hit your first tennis ball, that's a place you'll be able to do it. The community can use it. We want to train coaches and send them out to the villages and different places where they can start their own business, run events. And then, you know, we're very fortunate. You have the university there. You have great schools there. So from an educational point of view, as well, you know, the players that's going to be there, you know, will have the best way when it comes to education. And then it's going to be a great place for foreigners to come. We know the Western Cape is very popular for wine, golf, and now I have a proper tennis facility as well. And we're very fortunate because, you know, Craig's involved. Craig studied at the university. You know, Billie Jean King is married to Ilana Kloss. Billie Jean King and Ilana is very much involved. And, you know, yeah, and then we have one or two, you know, some strong business people that are, you know, supporting us. And we want more people, you know, more people involved that can donate money so we can build this great facility for Africa. And it's going to be a game changer for us.
Indoor stadium, indoor courts, 40 bedrooms. This is not a small project. Ipso facto, it is not an inexpensive project. How close are you? Ideally, when would we like to see this coming through?
Well, we obviously would like to see it ASAP. We still have, you know, we're probably 60% there. 40% of the money and the you know, the property is great that we got the property donated because that's very big. So we've got some, you know, I'm going to Indian Wells at the end of the month. So we've got some very important meetings there. And, you know, hopefully as soon as possible, we'll be able to start doing something because, you know, like Billy also said, we wanted it to happen yesterday. But, I mean, it takes time and we're very fortunate that, you know, and thankful to the people that's already involved. And, yeah, if there's people that, you know, want to help us with this, you know, it's definitely, we're never going to say no because, you know, for the African continent, it's going to be great. It's also going to be the Hall of Fame is going to be there. We have such a rich history, South Africa and Africa, when it comes to tennis. And Africa is a sleeping giant, man. There's so many great athletes that's, you know, walking around. We just got to – and it's expensive now for us to go to Europe and train. You know, it's big money when you want to go train at Rafa Nadal's Academy or, you know, any of these academies. So if we can do it back here and create the best place training with each other, it will be massive for us.
Well, in the spirit of generosity and contribution, I'm very happy to come along and help with some of the coaching, drawing from my Watershed College first team captain days. And if you need a resident sommelier for the tennis academy, I think I'd definitely be up for that job as well. But also, more seriously, there is as one of many cheerleaders, because I think when we look back at the South African high points of the last 20, 30, 40 years, time and again, we come back to sport as to what's made us proud, what's made us smile, what's brought us together as a country. And to be able to start seeing some South Africans filter into the Grand Slams, into the second week of these big tournaments would be amazing. But also to have this space for the next generation of continental talent would be incredible. So I'm really excited that this is on the way, and I wish you the best of luck.
No, thank you, Dan. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a great sport. It's a sport that's brought so much, you know, happiness to me and, you know, experience. It's a sport that took me around the world. I'm fortunate. I mean, travel around the world every day, meeting new people, getting new experiences. And, you know, for us to come back and, you know, to share that with people in South Africa is great. We one of our other projects is we just built two clay courts here in Modderfontein. Because clay is a surface that South Africans don't have. You know, there's some clay courts at the University of Pukka, and then we have 2 years. So it's also great now because now people can feel what it feels like to play on the clay. And, you know, for our juniors as well, because normally we go 2 days before a clay court tournament, we arrive there, you train for 2 days, and then you got to play. The rest of Europe and America, they can train on clay. So we're very fortunate that we can have these two clay courts now. And not just for the high performance, but I think for social people, for people like you. I think we've got to have like a little Dan Nicol podcast there at, you know, Modderfontein clay courts and see how you slide.
I'd be 100% up for it. Although I did play on some clay growing up, but the surface we used mostly in rural Zimbabwe. And one I still don't know why you don't have a grand slam on this surface, and that was tarmac. Which I think very underrated as a global tennis service. Tennis balls lasted about a day. So lots to look forward to, lots to be excited about. And we'll ask you to stay in touch and keep us posted on how Match in Africa grows, how the events out at Irene, how the Stellenbosch Centre. There is a lot to look forward to. But I want to finish up by dipping into some nostalgia and going back once again. All of the games that you played through your career, and what a career it was. The ones I sometimes find that we think players will look back at with the most fondness are actually not, because there's sometimes reasons you don't know. Mm. You know, somebody's just come back from a miraculous injury, or something had happened in the build-up and they didn't expect to do well. What is, from your playing days, the tennis memory that you cherish the most? The one that, as you put your feet up at the end of a long day, sometimes flickers back into the mind and just gives you a nice, big, warm smile.
There's two for me. When I was 12, when I won the Junior Nationals, the winners went to Sport Goofy to play in the World Championships, and it was at Disney World. And I just remembered I was so happy because the only thing I knew about Disney was the Sunday movie and the castle with all the, you know, fireworks, and, you know, winning that and knowing, yeah, I'm going to go to Disney World. I was so excited. And then for sure, I mean, the first time I qualified for singles at Wimbledon, I'll never forget it. It's the first time I played five sets. It was on grass.
Who did you play against?
Steve De Vries. So both of us were actually doubles guys. He was a doubles guy, but he took out the seed in the quarter, and I took the number two seed in the quarter. So then we ended up playing each other. And in Roehampton, the grass was so bad, man, you didn't let the ball bounce. I mean, you half volleyed, the serve got to the net, you served and volleyed because the grass was really so bad. But it was probably the best moment of my tennis career, just when I won that match and realized that I'm going to play at the real Wimbledon now. And that set it for me in my tennis career, because it's something I dreamt about. When I was young, I was lying in my bed dreaming about playing at Wimbledon. And yeah, the first time I walked in there was special, man. It's a special place.
I've got goosebumps just imagining it. JL, thank you, not just for all the great tennis memories, but thank you for what you're doing for tennis. It's a really, really exciting, ambitious agenda you have ahead of you. But if anyone can deliver on it with the network and the passion, then it is certainly you. I look forward to doing whatever I can to support and be part of it and to watch it all unfold. And I'm also looking forward to a couple of those young names you mentioned starting to filter into the WTA and ATP tours and seeing that South African flag flying in some big tournaments.
No, thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
Okay. A great, great tennis career, a man who did so much all around the world and now does the same in the coaching world, where you speak to the top guns. Who are the guys who really know what they're doing when they're coaching? And the name JL Diaga comes to the fore very soon indeed. He's a national treasure in terms of tennis, and with so much more to come, expect to hear a lot more from him and a lot more about South African tennis in the months and years to come. Joining me on the Dan Nicholls Show this week, John Lufney Diaga.
You're listening to The Dan Nicholls Show.